Ready for a career addressing pressing environmental issues? Check out Georgetown University's 10-month Master's in Environment and Sustainability Management, an interdisciplinary program that combines principles of environmental science with a skill set in business. Learn from world-class sustainability leaders as you pursue your passion and prepare to make a meaningful difference in business and society, solving sustainability challenges and creating value for organizations across the globe. Located in Washington, D.C., the program delivers unparalleled access to policymakers, nonprofits, global corporations, and government entities. Plus, you'll join a powerful alumni network ranked third in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Explore the program at esm.georgetown.edu/nation.
Welcome to the Nation Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of our biggest stories with the journalists who wrote them. I'm Dee Dee Guttenplan, special correspondent for The Nation and host of The Nation Podcast. Yolanda Díaz, Spain's high-profile labor minister, has managed a tightrope walk unthinkable in the country's recent history. Much to the astonishment of her critics, she's mitigated inflation while staving off the far right and delivering material improvements for the people of Spain. A proven coalition builder and deal maker between unions and corporations as a labor lawyer, as a minister, Díaz is now fighting for a shorter work week, a proposal that the vast majority of Spaniards support, but that will require even more deft political maneuvering in the months to come. How has Díaz managed to steer Spain from a years-long economic slump to its current position as the world's fastest-growing large economy? Why doesn't her party, Sumar, have more power in Spain? And will her reform agenda be adopted by a broader leftist international movement, as she hopes? Joining us to answer some of these questions is longtime Nation contributor, labor journalist Sarah Jaffe, author of From the Ashes, Grief and Revolution in a World on Fire. Sarah, it's great to have you here at the Nation Podcast.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Let's go back a little bit in time, because for anybody except the most faithful readers of the Nation or people who are deeply interested in Spanish politics, we last checked in on Spain during the Podemos years. So what happened to all of that promise?
Oh, it's a that's a long story. We could go on forever and ever and ever.
Well, you
right?
give us the short version.
Yeah. So Podemos was a left party that came together out of the movement of the squares, the Indignados, people might be familiar with, which was the movement in Spain after the 2008 financial crisis, right? So like the Spanish equivalent of Occupy, but that sprang up faster and managed to consolidate itself into some sort of political party that did some experimenting with different forms. My friend Paolo Grabado, who I interviewed for this piece, wrote about them in his book, The Digital Party, alongside things like the Five Star Movement in Italy, which is less of a left-wing party. And so Podemos was always sort of an unstable coalition. It was trying to do parties differently in the era past the sort of mass membership party. And I can go on about all of this stuff for a long time, but suffice it to say that there have been a combination of splits within Podemos over political issues, over personal issues, over corruption scandals, over questions of whether its leaders were too high on their own supply. And most recently, one of its former leaders, who had then split, formed his own party and joined Yolanda Díaz's Sumar coalition, then was accused of sexual misconduct and had to step down in disgrace. So, basically everywhere, right, the left in Spain has struggled to cohere the populist energy that soared after the 2008 financial crisis into a solid vehicle for not just taking, but holding political power. Podemos was in government as part of a coalition. That's how Yolanda Díaz first came into government as a sort of junior member of the Podemos coalition. And then with the fall of Podemos, that was reversed in the most recent couple of governments where she is the labor minister from her own coalition, Sumar.
Right. I suppose what I found a little bit confusing and dispiriting and at the same time hopeful, all these emotions at once, is, you know, with Podemos, we had a left populist party in power.
Yeah.
And
sharing power, but yes.
Yeah, sharing power, but, you know, able to shape the not just the government, but the discourse and the window of what was deemed politically possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, the implosion of that, for whatever reason, and, you know, I feel bad about this, isn't something that the nation paid such close attention to.
Yeah. Yeah, this has been a kind of a thing that I've noticed a lot on the U.S. left, is that when things are exciting, we're really excited about them and we want to be part of them. And, you know, I'm speaking to you from London, where you also, you know, lived and reported for quite a long time. And, you know, there was similar excitement and interest in Jeremy Corbyn. And then we haven't heard a peep about England since. Right. And so, yeah, we don't sort of follow the travails quite as much.
Or the wilderness years, or but you know, the I suppose the, and that was a great summary, thank you. I mean, I suppose the part that I find hopeful in all that is that throughout all this difficulty, there's been a left or center left government that has still remained in power. So how did they manage that?
Whew. I mean, it's so fascinating right now, right? I, you know, you've been looking at, I, like everyone, have been sort of watching what's going on in Palestine, and the Spanish government has been one of the few that has said anything, let alone done anything, to actually try to bring a halt to the devastation that's going on in Gaza. And, you know, you're watching this, again, this coalition that has been between the PSOE, the Socialist Party of Spain, and Pedro Sanchez, who, you know, for all his faults, and there are plenty, still remains sort of a charismatic leader that hangs on. You know, his polling was, you know, just a little bit better than Keir Starmer's over here, who's, you know, in turn just a little bit better than Macron, which is to say, these
not
people
so
are
great.
All in the negatives.
Yeah.
Not so great. But he has managed to do again, you know, on the flip side, right, the dance of working with the left, bringing them into the coalition, giving them some power, right? You know, again, the point, what often happens to these left-wing parties in sort of European coalitions, right, is they get brought in as the junior partner, they get tossed a bone in some ministry that they can't really do anything with, and then they lose when their coalition partner inevitably screws up and flops. And that, at least the part where they are not given any power, has not been true in this case, right? So Yolanda Diaz has been at the labor ministry, where she is actually able to shape policy, raise the minimum wage a couple of times, really sort of renegotiate trade union law to actually improve bargaining positions for workers in a lot of Spanish industries, lower unemployment. These are things that, you know, they should be common sense. They're common sense to me, but I've been a labor journalist for 16 years. So watching her actually be allowed to do this rather than be kind of like squashed and told to shut up, like the Bernie Sanders supporters were in the Democratic Party, it's instructive, I think, or it could be instructive if the Democrats wanted to learn anything.
Yes. Well, I mean, they're, you know, I think that's absolutely right. That, and I'm glad you drew the parallel, because it's interesting. One of the points you make in her story is that the idea that one way to share a rising economy is with all the people who are affected by it is to shorten the work week.
Right.
You know, and that's something concrete that doesn't require the government to spend money.
Yeah.
And it also materially changes workers' lives, which is,
right,
you know, if the Democratic Party had paid any attention to materially changing workers' lives, we might not be in the second Trump administration.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I think, and, you know, to be as fair as I can possibly be to the Biden administration, I do think they knew they had to do that, but they could not sort of get over these sort of fiddly around the edges, little neoliberal policy ideas that if they deliver material changes, it's for not enough workers and not fast enough to make a difference.
Well, and also they weren't prepared to play the kind of hard politics on delivering benefits to workers that they were prepared to play on, for example, Ukraine or, you know, increasing defense spending. So, and also, I suppose if we're being fair, we should say that it's easier to deliver these kind of changes in a parliamentary system because by definition, you have a majority, a working majority in the parliament.
Yeah. Although, you know, it is worth noting that one of the reasons this shorter hours bill, which is a pretty small shorter hours bill, this is not a 4-day week bill by any stretch of the imagination. It's, you know, bringing the work week down to 37 and a half hours. So, you know, again, it does kind of fall into that problem of being like a fiddly little reform in a way. But part of the reason it hasn't passed yet is that the coalition that has Sanchez and Diaz hanging on to power by the skin of their teeth, despite all of these successes, it includes some sort of right-leaning parties, including these sort of smaller nationalist parties in Catalonia and the Basque region that are tied to business. And business does not want this, even though, again, it's a pretty small change.
Right. Okay, so one more general question, and then I want to get on to Yolanda Diaz. And the general question is, so there's there's a Basque party, a Catalan party.
Yeah.
Who are the other members of this coalition?
So it's a bit confusing, too, because we're talking about two coalitions. There's sort of the coalition government, which includes the PSOE, SUMAR, which is itself a coalition, and then a number of these smaller parties that, again, we could go into, but everybody's eyes are going to glaze over.
Right.
But so they are smaller parties that were convinced to sort of go along with this because they would get some sort of something that they wanted. And, you know, because the right, while some of these sort of, you know, right-leaning nationalist parties in Basque and Catalonia might seem to have more in common with something like Vox, which is the right-wing party. In fact, you know, Vox, its campaign ads that we noted and ran a picture of with this piece also include them, throwing Catalan nationalism in the trash too. So they're sticking around because they get something in terms of regional or national, depending on how you define these things. Independence and sovereignty that they were certainly not going to get from the far right or even the sort of mainstream right-wing party, which is itself pretty far right.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we're talking about all of these sort of moving parts, again, this is the downside of the parliamentary system, right? You know, ostensibly you have a majority, but in practice, sort of like Joe Manchin being in the being the part of the Democrats' majority, you don't really.
Right. You have a coalition which, you know, in many cases fractures. And I suppose it's also worth noting two other things about the sort of the ground of Spanish politics.
Yeah.
One being that Spaniards have an experience of an actual dictatorship that the American right, for example, does not have.
Yeah.
And that has made Vox a little more toxic and maybe held them off from taking power in the way that, for example, the fascist party in Maloney or in Italy, the neo-fascist party in Italy has been able to come into power.
Yeah, it's just more recent living memory for people in Spain, right? Franco was still in power when Diaz was born, and Diaz is not that much older than me. You can see pictures of Mussolini, and Italians certainly remember that, but it is long enough ago that it's not in living memory for that many people.
Right.
And so, you know, the experience, it does hit a little bit differently, I think. You know, it's more present. But also, you know, that also means it is still present in some of these social structures. Again, some of the folks I talked to pointed out that the judiciary, which is playing a big role in these corruption scandals that the PSOE is battling, is the branch of government that's been sort of least reformed since the Franco era.
Right. So it's not just social structures, it's also governmental structures. Mm-hmm. Okay, exactly. So Yolanda Diaz, who is she? Where does she come from? How did she get here?
So Yolanda Diaz is from Galicia. Pardon my Spanish pronunciation and certainly my regional pronunciations are terrible. I apologize to everyone. But she was a labor lawyer and her father was a longtime Communist Party activist. And she followed in his footsteps, but in the sort of more wearing a suit and sitting at the table bargaining with capitalists rather than, you know, trying to beat them in the streets. And she comes out of longstanding ties with the labor movement, and she still maintains a membership in the Communist Party, which the right-wing press never tires of reminding people. And she was, again, she was part of the, you know, the Podemos coalition, but not technically a part of Podemos. And again, there's so many coalitions, I apologize to everyone. And she's worked on sort of labor issues. She's worked on gender issues, pulling together networks of women politicians in Spain. And she has risen to prominence by having this reputation for being quite pragmatic in her approach, even as she's proposing things that are actually transformative. And this is a combination that I think is, it's hard to come by, you know? And it, if it reminds me of anyone, it actually reminds me of Bernie in the Senate. You know what I mean? Where he's actually like an incredibly effective senator at getting things done and getting things passed. But most people don't really think of that when they think of Bernie. They think of him out on the campaign trail yelling about the billionaire class. So Yolanda Diaz was pointed out to me several years ago as sort of this up-and-coming person. She was one of the most popular politicians in Spain for a little bit. She was the most popular politician in Spain. And I actually was on a sort of Zoom panel that she hosted in 2021 or 2022 after my book Work Won't Love You Back came out. And yeah, and then this past year, I was invited to come speak at this International Labor Congress that she was putting on. And this is an attempt to, you know, counter the fact that the rising far right is networking, that in fact, right, the Vox Party had sort of brought together what Diaz calls the International of Hate. And to counter that, she brought together labor ministers, parliamentarians, union activists, organizers, and a couple of weirdos like me to talk about what international labor policy would be like. And, you know, unfortunately for me, it happened about 4 days after Trump was reelected. So
I got more your contribution was more theoretical than practical.
My contribution, because, you know, they're like, what would an international labor law framework look like? And I was like, well, the U.S. is going to violate it. So I'm more thinking about what we do outside of the law at this point. But it was a fascinating experience to sort of sit there for 2 days and watch her doing what she seems to do best, which is bring together an alliance, a coalition, a network, a movement, she would say, to talk about materially changing working people's lives.
Well, it's so interesting. I mean, you know, the weakness of the left in power is that we tend to split. And sumar literally means come together or unite. Yeah. So she's kind of building a mini, what to at least this historically minded American looks like a popular front of the left party. Mm-hmm. And pursuing those kind of politics, which of course are never as satisfying as the kind of purist posturing that you can do if you're not doing that.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I think this is really interesting. And one of the reasons that I am sort of fascinated by her and by the question of like, can this incredibly popular woman create a party that isn't just about her? Because she remains popular, she remains in power. Sumar really struggled at the last elections. And so the answer so far has seemed to be kind of no. And the thing that, that again, I was talking about with Paulo Garbato in his book, The Digital Party, which I really highly recommend to everyone, in this time of sort of reduced trust in party structures, in the PASOKification, as they call it, the sort of hollowing out of you know, left, center-left parties in Europe, and again,
alluding to the party that was in power for a long time in Greece.
The Greek Social Democratic Party, yeah.
And that exploded during the financial crisis.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, I am speaking to you from Keir Starmer's Britain, where, again, his approval ratings after simply 1 year in part and power have plummeted. And we should also note that he had to fire Peter Mandelson today over the Epstein files. So that's been fun.
So there's been progress.
There has been progress. I was on another podcast this week talking about Peter Mandelson and Trump's tech deal. And 2 days later, you know, it's dated because Peter Mandelson is no longer the ambassador to the U.S. Peter Mandelson, for people who, again, don't follow British politics, was the sort of kind of the Rahm Emanuel to Tony Blair. Yeah,
he was like totally the Rahm Emanuel to Tony Blair. And then when he became a member of the House of Lords, he was known, at least among the left press, as the Dark Lord.
So yeah.
I couldn't have happened to a nicer guy.
Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. So we can toast the demise of Peter Mandelson. But the problem remains that you don't have trust in these parties anymore. So instead, you end up with what Paolo calls the hyper leader, who communicates sort of directly with the base, often using social media. Podemos's leader, Pablo Iglesias, was really a great example of this. He sort of, you know, became famous going on TV and the radio during the financial crisis and talking, well, sense. But the problem is then, like, what are the democratic structures that you're building here and how do you do these things? And, you know, it's a live question in a lot of cases, right? Like, we're watching, on the one hand, Zoran Mamdani, right, who is this exciting new leader that you would think if the Democrats wanted to learn something or maintain power, they would be thrilled to have this charismatic 33-year-old who blew Andrew Cuomo out of the water. But instead, it's attempting to sabotage him at any way that it can. And they can't quite get rid of him because the Democratic Party isn't really a party. But, you know, on the flip side, we're watching, again,
Keir
Starmer.
They're certainly not embracing him.
I
want to take us back to Spain because I think there are two things that we really need to get deep into. And one is this bill, which is, you know, as you say, it's only from 40 to 37 and a half hours. But, you know, as they sung in the pajama game or almost 30 minutes every day, give it to me every day.
Yeah.
It matters, and people will feel it. And also the party can remind people of it. So what is the time frame for it, and how is the fight going?
The fight is going, and it is so far not been brought up for a vote because they do not appear to have the votes. There is a lot of deal-making being discussed. Again, it's questions of, like, subsidies for small businesses and things like that and blah, 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 that, like, would ostensibly get some fraction of capital on board with this reduction. And it's interesting because, right, shorter hours have come back in a big way. Everybody from the UAW to Bernie Sanders to, you know, certainly a big movement across a lot of the European left have been talking about shorter work weeks and particularly talking about the four-day week. And the four-day week, this is not, right? But it's the idea that you can ratchet it down a little bit, and then maybe you can ratchet it down a little bit more. And you can, you know, as Diaz says, sort of redistribute productivity, because we've had productivity gains for decades that have not been distributed to the people who are doing the work, right? They've been captured in the form of profits. And so, you know, especially right now with AI, we're being told that it's going to, you know, replace all of us. If that's actually true, and we actually just don't need as many people to work for as many hours, what does it look like to give us a shorter working week without a reduction in pay, right? What does it look like to
And how do we make sure that the benefits of having some tasks taken on by AI are not all pocketed by the owners of the technology?
Exactly. And so this is not just a question of large language models, certainly, right? Automation has been around since capitalism. And the challenge here, one of the interesting things of it is that because it's a small reform, it's hard to get people really, really, really fired up about it.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So this is what I heard.
So maybe they should have made a bigger ask.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, if you come in for a 4-day week and you bargain down to 37.5 hours, then, you know, the business people feel like they've won something from you and you've still gotten the reduction. And it's one of those things that, you know, I am a huge proponent, as people who have read my work in The Nation and elsewhere know, of shorter working weeks. That you have to give people something that's sort of big enough and exciting enough that they're really willing to fight for it. Because things like this, you know, capital is going to fight you tooth and nail on any little reform that gives them less power over workers' lives.
Right. So you don't have a sense of when this is likely to come up for a vote, and is there a point in the parliament where if it doesn't come up for a vote, it will be tabled and die?
And, you know, it can definitely sort of slowly die in committee, in parliament, in deal making, particularly if some of these scandals actually do succeed in bringing down this government. Right. So, you know, it's taken on this sort of meaning because the government is so embattled right now and because they've been able to do much less in this term than they were in the previous term. Because again, their majority is so small, and it does rest on these little sort of, you know, center right national regional parties. Yeah, that if they don't pass this, it's going to really be a sign that they are toast, and that would be bad. So, watching, you know, and I was sort of, because of course we've been figuring out where to put this piece in a print magazine.
Right.
I was joking with my editor that, you know, I was like, you know what's going to happen is as soon as we go to print, it's either going to pass or the government's going to fall. So neither of those things have happened since we've been talking. But now, you know, it'll probably happen next week before this podcast comes out. So it's really hard. You look at all the successes of this government and think they should be more popular.
Why didn't Sumar win more seats in last summer's European elections?
That is a very interesting question. I think there are a lot of reasons that the party has sort of been seen as a junior partner. It has been a little incoherent what it is. You know, Diaz talks about it as a democratic movement rather than a party. But like, what does that actually mean in practice? There have not been people who have sort of stepped up and been as visible and recognizable faces as Diaz. And yeah, I think particularly when it comes to the European elections, you also get lower turnout and people, you know, protest vote and all sorts of stuff that, like, it's hard to compare one-to-one to the U.S. process, right? But I think, yeah, you have to, again, take into account these questions of, like, what are we building here and how are we, like, really building it, and are we building it from the bottom up rather than from the top down?
Right. Well, let's talk about, that's the second topic I wanted to talk about, which is why or how. Yeah, the second topic I wanted to talk about before we go is corruption. And it seems to me that Spain is a really good example of why the left really needs to care about corruption because of what it can do to you, because it can tell people that it doesn't matter who's in politics because all they're going to do is line their pockets and help their friends.
Exactly. And this is kind of what, you know, what Kema Martinez from the CCOO union was saying, right? He's like, the far right, people don't want them on policy, on whatever, but they kind of feel like it's inevitable. And the far right is making an argument that basically democracy itself is a corrupt system where, you know, the politicians just buy people off with goodies. And this is, again, you hear this in the way, you know, Andrew Cuomo talks about Zorro. It's like, oh, he's just offering you free stuff.
Right.
Well, yeah, isn't that what the government's for? And this idea, this portrayal of the politicians who are trying to improve your life as self-interested. Again, it plays into the same thing as when, you know, businesses say that unions just want your money. They just want your dues, right? It's a denial of the idea that anything can change and that, like, we could be an expression of how people care about each other. I keep thinking of the thing that Colin Smalley, who's one of the leaders of the Federal Unionist Network in the U.S., said to me. He's like, you know, they're trying to, you know, take an axe to the entire idea that we should care about each other as people by wrecking all the parts of the government that do anything good for people. And so, right, so corruption, and again, we're, you know, there's a lot of sort of lawfare going on in the courts. The question of are these, all of these corruption scandals really corruption scandals?
Right.
But some of them definitely are. And that is why we have to care, right? It's also why we have to care about sexual harassment. Same reasons, right? I mean, A, you should care about these things on principle. But B, because if you don't, they undermine the very thing that you are trying to argue for.
Yeah.
Which is that you care about people who don't have all the power.
And that shifting power to a party that claims to represent the people
yeah.
will actually benefit people.
Right, exactly. And it won't just end up in those same people taking advantage. And I'm thinking of Andrew Cuomo's sexual harassment scandals. I'm also thinking of Angela Rayner, who had to step down here in Britain, right, over not paying the appropriate tax on her house purchase, right? Like, these are the images that people have of, you know, center-left politicians in power.
Well, particularly when you're in, as the Labour Party certainly is in Britain, a hostile media environment. We could go on all day about the corruption of, you know, the Republican Party, Donald Trump, his friends, his allies.
Exactly.
But, you know, if you make a mistake on a mortgage application in the U.S. and you're a Democratic appointee, you are certainly going to be in the spotlight. So don't make those mistakes, people.
Well, and you know, I think it's really important. Again, this is why you need to have democratic structures of accountability rather than hyper leaders, right? And I know I'm saying this as we're talking about a profile that I wrote of a leader. But I think the thing, again, that makes this such an interesting question to me is, what does it look like to meaningfully build political structure that can hold anyone, even Yolanda Diaz, even Pedro Sanchez,
accountable
for what they're doing?
Yeah, really interesting. Thank you so much, Sarah Jaffe. And you can get her book, From the Ashes, Grief and Revolution in a World on Fire, wherever you get your books.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have Leaf Filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.